Hi, welcome to Two Truths and a Dirty Lie, a podcast about facts, figures, and weird things from the past. I'm your host, Dez, and I'm here with my co-host, Timoteo.
Hey guys, welcome to Two Truths and a Dirty Lie. I hope you've been listening to the last couple of episodes. I hope you've been telling your friends about us on social media. I hope you're enjoying it as well.
Before we get into this week's topic, please remember to subscribe to our podcast and leave a review and a comment. We would appreciate any feedback you had for us.
So if you're on Apple Podcasts, just leave a review. You know, if you're on Spotify, leave your rating. Everything really helps us grow and it helps keep this sustainable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So Two Truths and a Dirty Lie is a podcast where every week I'll tell Tim Tyo three quote-unquote facts and he'll try and figure out what is true and what is the dirty lie. This week's topic, I'm so excited, is scams. If anyone doesn't know what 419 is, it is the section of criminal code which criminalizes internet scams in the Nigerian criminal code.
Not just internet. If you look at early history, it was just really any sort of mail order scam, any sort of criminal activity which involved gaining someone's trust and using that to elicit funds from them illegally.
Yes, so the code says that anyone who by any false pretense or intent to defraud obtains from any other person anything capable of being stolen or induces them to deliver them with anything capable of being stolen is guilty of a felony and is liable to imprisonment.
In our research, we found like 2 of the earliest scams recorded in Nigerian history.
And this is exciting to get into. But you know what, Tataya? I think there's been a reoccurrence of scammers in our current culture, right? I think people are very interested with scams now in social media with the Anna Delvey Netflix special. And I feel personally, even though Nigerians are seen as scammers and now internet scam is being used in the same sentence as Nigeria often, I think the original scammers are white women.
Blonde white women.
No, first of all, why are they always blonde? They are usually blonde. I mean, Anna Delvey isn't blonde, but if you look at the history of like scamming white women of the world, a lot of them are blonde. Like the Theranos babe, Elizabeth Holmes. Yeah. Who literally faked her own voice. Like, she faked her deep voice. There is actually a podcast where she was being interviewed and she forgot for a second and used her real voice.
And the interviewer was starting like, what?
What's going on? Happening? And then she quickly went back to... Have you heard of the real life Gone Girl?
No.
Oh, there's this lady. Her name is Sherry Papini. And her name was in the headlines in 2016 in America because they thought she was missing, you know, and she was a missing wife and mother. They thought that maybe her husband had murdered her or maybe she had been kidnapped. And literally just last month, she admitted to faking her kidnapping from 2016. She accepted a plea bargain because she was charged and she... you know, came out and said, I'm deeply sorry. I'm deeply ashamed for my behavior and the pain I've caused. She literally just wanted to go off with her lover and faked a kidnapping. Like, it was a very elaborate situation.
Is she blonde?
She is blonde. She is. So, today's two truths and a dirty lie. Number one. In the 1920s, a con man named Victor Lustig sold the Eiffel Tower twice. Number two, in 1817, a con woman from the UK convinced the British public that she was actually a princess caribou from Javasu, a made-up island near Indonesia. And number three, the first Nigerian prince scams was a scam in the 1940s placed in a newspaper which deceived the British public into sending money to Nigeria.
Oh, this is tough. This is actually tough. You know what? I'm going to go with the first one.
The first one is a lie.
Yeah. Please tell me I'm right.
Oh, so you think there's no way a man saw the Eiffel Tower twice?
Wait, hold on. Let me think again. Eiffel Tower. A Nigerian prince. And what's the other one?
The other one is the woman from Bristol who pretended to be an Indonesian princess. That seems realistic.
Because Bristol's a seaport, so I can see that happening. I think the lie is the Eiffel Tower.
I love this because I keep winning.
Oh, no. No, just once.
So, I mean, you know what?
Just once, I would like to be
correct. You'd like to be correct. As I always say, fact is stranger than fiction. I'll start with number one because it's true. So Victor Lustig was a con artist who was originally from Austria-Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
And he undertook a criminal career that spanned both Europe and America.
Okay.
He is known as the man who sold the Eiffel Tower twice. In fact, his scams were so legendary that other scammers started pretending they were him. So in the historical record, it's very hard to tell which which scams were Victor Lustig and which scams were other scammers pretending to be Victor Lustig as they were scamming
people.
He had copycats. He has one very iconic copycat, or maybe someone who he inspired, which was a man called Natarwal in India, who managed to sell the Taj Mahal three times.
Three times?
Yes. He sold the Taj Mahal three times, which honestly, some of these scams, you just have to wonder, like, who are they scamming? But it's foreigners. The guy sold the Eiffel Tower three times. The guy sold the Taj Mahal three times to foreigners.
Yeah.
He was able to forge the president's signature. Wow. He even sold monuments, and he sold the Indian House of Commons, or the Indian Parliament to foreigners.
He sold the building.
No, he sold the Parliament, including the 54 members.
What?
It's so. I think one of the most interesting thing about scammers is that often they do target the greed in people, right? Because that is a very greedy thing. How can you believe that you are buying the Indian Parliament? You're like, oh, Indians are corrupt and whatever, so I'm sure they're for purchase.
Yeah.
Or 54
I can influence the policy of the largest
country
at that point in time.
Yeah.
India was probably the largest colony.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, let's talk about Victor Lustig, the legendary con man. So he was born in Austria-Hungary, and when he was 19, he took a break from schooling and studying and being a regular teenager, and decided to go to Paris and start gambling. And apparently, like, he was so good at gambling that people just refused to play with him. And he also, so he had a problem, right? His problem was money and women, which Joe often is.
Yeah.
He was able to pretend to be a gentleman because he had a scar on his head given to him by the boyfriend of a woman who he was trying to chase.
Yes.
And that scar helped people believe he was a gentleman, because in that era, with German-born men or men from Austria-Hungary, apparently for the gentlemen, a lot of them had scars on their faces from dueling, and it became a common thing to fake a scar. Like, they would actually, it's like me asking you to just jab me in the head so I look like we were dueling, right? Because people wanted to use this to prove that they were true men and true gentlemen.
When you say dueling, do you mean with guns or swords?
So this is in 1890, I want to assume, I'm not sure. But
yeah, I imagine guns would be illegal, so let's go with swords.
Yeah, I'm not sure, so let me not say that. Also, he heard that Americans were dumb people while he was in Paris, So he was like, oh, the best...
And exceedingly rich.
And exceedingly rich. He was like, I heard America is the land of milk and honey and it's full of idiots. So let me scam them. But he didn't actually have any interest in moving to America at this point in time. Mm. So what he would do is that he would go on ocean liners that were going between Europe and New York City and scam the Americans on those ocean liners.
So he would get to New York but never set foot.
Yeah. And so these transatlantic ocean liners, all, he would come and say, I'm Count Victor Lustig. Mm-hmm. He also didn't really speak English.
That probably made it easier for him to scam people.
He would have a translator.
Oh, gosh.
So people would be like, he must be so important. This man has a translator. He's a gentleman in his gentlemanly robes and scar on his head. And he can barely speak English. Do you know how talented you have to be to scam people who you can't even understand?
Yeah.
And who can't understand you?
Yeah.
So yeah, he was on ocean liners for a while. He would run a scam. He would usually have a partner and you have a translator. He started to gain kind of like an infamy and a reputation for these scams. So he decided, you know what, let me move away from this scam. And then he moved to Bond, right?
Yeah.
And then after that, he then moves to America. He's like, you know what, I'm tired of just scamming these people on their journey home. Let me move in with them and scam them well. Scam them well.
Okay.
So he's up, moving up and down the East Coast in America, scamming people out of money. And he felt like, not necessarily a Robin Hood, but he felt like a moral scammer because he felt like he only scammed people who were greedy.
Yeah.
So he had this thing called the Romanian box, which is one of his most notable scams, where he would claim that he had a box that could print dollar bills, like print replica of any dollar bill you put inside.
Mm.
And how he did this is that he had some $100 bills that he would that he had changed the serial number on, and so they were all identical, and he would go up to the person who he's scamming and he would put one of these dollar bills in the box and tell them this is the mechanism and you have to wait, crank the box, and he's like, oh, we have to wait 12 hours, it takes a while to to print this money, and the box would just be doing 12 hours later he would pull out the cash that he had, you know, already had, right, and be like, oh, and they'll be like, wow, this works, this is incredible. And people believe that the box had actually printed a replica of the original $100 note.
This is insane.
Yes. And the thing about it is that the people who he was scamming were doing something illegal. So a lot of them could not go to the authorities once they realized that they had been scammed.
Mm.
And he also, he always had a 12-hour
window.
Yeah, 12-hour window to just get up and get out of town. He'll sell the box. He'll be like, peace. And by the time they're trying to crank this box for 12 hours...
They open it and they see a watch inside.
And they open it and they see nothing. Paper, like nothing is coming out. The box isn't working. And he's out. He's left town. He has a 12-hour head start. He's out.
I love that.
And
you can't even, it's not even about talking to the authorities. You can't even tell your friends about that.
Because honestly...
Like, they look at you like you're insane.
And there was actually this guy who messaged Lustig and he was like, oh, yo, the box isn't working, but I think I'm doing something wrong. Like, I think maybe I cranked it too early. Maybe I didn't wait the actual 12 hours. He didn't even realize he was being scammed. He thought he was doing the wrong. People bought into this scam and he did it up and down the United States, from New York to Chicago. He even scammed a Texas sheriff.
Mm.
And the sheriff took it very personal, because he had bought it for thousands of dollars. And this is in 1925. So thousands of dollars then, it now would be a huge sum of money.
Mm-hmm.
And the sheriff took it personally. And he was a sheriff. So he chased Lustig down to Chicago. And when the sheriff got to Chicago and found Lustig, Lustig convinced the sheriff that, oh, you're not doing it properly. And through sleight of hand, he used one of the identical bills he had with him to prove to the sheriff that the guy wasn't working the machine properly. That's what the issue was.
Yeah.
That it wasn't that he was scammed. But let's talk about his Eiffel Tower scam.
Please.
The legendary Eiffel Tower scam. So in 1925, Luther kind of got bored and he was like, let me go to Paris. And he had no idea what scam he was going to pull. He believed in his own ingenuity. Mm-hmm. He was just like, I'll get to Paris and I'll figure out what I'm going to do when I get there. So he just, you know, takes a ship to Paris, gets to Paris and is walking around and sees this big Eiffel Tower. And he hears a lot of French people complaining in the newspapers that, you know, they have to repair the Eiffel Tower. It's really ugly. It's really expensive. Like, we should just get rid of it. Why do we have to keep repairing this monstrosity of this metal clunk that is in the middle of Paris? Mm. And mind you, Paris saw itself as this artistic, you know,
Advanced city,
a center of art and beautiful things. And they just thought the Eiffel Tower was a clunk of metal. And so Lustig was like, bet I'm going to be able to convince people that the French government wants to sell the Eiffel Tower.
Okay.
So he researched, you know, the French government, he researched the Parisian people, and he was able to fake government stationery, pretending to be the deputy general of posts and telegraphs, and went to one of the most distinguished hotels in Paris, sent out the stationery from the hotel, and called all these businessmen to this meeting, saying, you guys, we have to keep this on the low. The French government wants to sell the Eiffel Tower, but we have to keep, you know, that we're trying to keep it on the low until we actually sell it, because there's so much controversy around this Eiffel Tower.
How was his French, by the way?
It was good. So so at this point in time, I think he was speaking multiple languages. He just didn't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, Europeans in that time, all of them spoke
French, Spanish,
German, like that kind of thing. So he did speak French, and he told these businessmen that the French government wanted to sell it for scrap. Like scrap metal, right? So he got some scrap metal guys, and everyone's like, wow, like whoever bags this deal is gonna blow. Like, like, and he had them bidding against each other, and he didn't even choose the highest bid. He chose the guy who he thought was the best to scam.
Oh, God.
And apparently he put a lot of effort into this scam.
A lot of thought.
He got them macaroons and desserts, but he didn't get the most expensive. But he was like, they would think the French government would get them really good snacks, but they wouldn't get the most expensive snacks, right? So he got really good, but not the most expensive snacks. He got really good stationery. He went to a really good hotel, but he did stuff to make people think that, okay, like our government has money, but they're a bit cheap. He really sold it, not just in this scam, but...
He was a civil servant in that sense.
Yeah. I think for me, one thing that was very impressive was his attention to detail. Because it's also a lot of people would just choose the highest bidder.
Yeah.
Or at least one of the highest bidders.
But he wasn't greedy. This was an art form for him.
It was an art form. So he sold it to this guy, and he was like, you know, he gave this speech and he was talking about how French government has realized that the Eiffel Tower doesn't fit in with our great monuments like the Gothic cathedrals or the Arc de Triomphe, and we just need to sell this scrap metal. Like, it can't just be standing there. And his mark was a man called André Poisson, who was an insecure man who wished to rise up amongst the inner circles of the Parisian business community.
That sounds like your prime target.
Yeah, he was like, Poisson was a keen... Like, he was just a keen guy, and he had a keen interest in being part of the high society, and he really wanted the monument. Like, he was pushing for it. And Lustig felt like, okay, you know what? That's the best guy to focus on. Another thing was that they expected some of their government officials to be corrupt.
Yeah.
So Lustig was like, I'm meeting you outside of government offices because I want a cut. So it's not just that we're selling this, but like, I want my own, my salary isn't that mad. You know, they sent me on this errand.
I am a humble civil servant.
I am a humble servant. So you need to pay me a huge bribe, and then you'll be able to be the person who wins this bid. Which, does that sound familiar to you?
Only a little bit.
Now, Lustig was able to get Poisson to give him this bribe of 70,000 francs. And then he jackpotted. He left town, went to Austria, cooling off. And when Poisson realized he had been scammed, he was too embarrassed to tell anyone or report it to the authorities.
I love that so much.
So Lustig was like, oh,
I can do this again.
I can do this again. So then he just like came back to Paris and was like, oh, one more time for the road. But then the second guys were a bit more, they were a bit shiftier than Poisson. They wanted to, so they were running with a scam, but they asked to meet him in like the office, the ministry, like the office building. And he was just like, I'm not feeling it. And then he left for the United States.
Okay.
But he did manage to sell the Eiffel Tower twice. Yeah. And also one thing that was really interesting is that when he went back to America, he decided to actually then start counterfeiting bills. Like instead of just running this scam in the box, he decided to counterfeit $100 bills. And he saw this as an art, you know? He paid attention to detail. Apparently his $100 bills are still considered by the US Treasury as one of the best forgeries ever.
Wow.
And that, I'm sure there are people who are trying to run that now with like much better technology. But in 1920s, Lustig was doing it with just sheer willpower.
And imagination.
And imagination. Apparently, he even asked Al Capone to invest $50,000 in one of his crooked schemes.
What did Al Capone say?
Capone felt he was dealing with an honest man. And because, oh man, so Lustig told Capone this was going to happen. You know, you give me this money, we'll run this deal and I'll give you, and you get your rewards back. Lustig kept the money for a long time and returned it to Capone and was like, oh, like it fell through. So Capone was like, oh, this is a, this is a real trustworthy dude. Like he's not running the scam immediately. He's not like, I'm taking your money, I'm going. He's building trust. Con men are what? Confidence men, right? Yeah. That's where the word con comes from. So he's building his Capone's confidence in him. And then he then convinced Capone to give him a smaller sum, $5,000. And Lustig now ran away with that.
This is so interesting.
I went to Nebraska.
Nebraska. I imagine his English was very decent by this time.
Yeah, he was counterfeiting the dollars from Nebraska.
Okay.
He had a pharmacist on his team.
Right.
I don't know, I guess maybe with the chemicals or the ink. I have no idea, but this is a man who thought these things through.
Mm.
He injected so many fake $100 bills into the US economy that the United States Secret Service, FBI, and CIA were like, okay, we have to find this dude.
The Joint Task Force.
Yeah. They were like, he's going to tank the value of the dollar.
One man.
He's too good at this.
Yeah.
He was arrested. When they found him in New York, they arrested him. He broke out of prison, of course.
He escaped.
Of course he escaped. He escaped twice. In fact, they found him going to a locker in Times Square with $51,000 of fake bills in it.
Wow.
Yeah. He escaped the day before his trial by faking an illness and using a specially made rope to climb out of the building. Apparently, when he was climbing out, some other inmates saw him, cheered him on.
And that's how he got caught.
No, he escaped.
Oh, he escaped.
Yeah, for 27 days though.
Oh, okay.
And then they found him, they put him back in jail for 5 years, but they were like, we're not putting you in regular jail, you're going to Alcatraz,
the island.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they put him in Alcatraz, and that is where he died.
Wow.
On his death certificate, his occupation was listed as an apprentice salesman. He also left a set of instructions known as the 10 commandments for con men.
Do you want to read them out?
I know you want to know this.
I really want to know what the 10 commandments for
The 10 commandments by Victor Lustig. Number one, be a patient listener. It is this, not fast talking, that gets a con man his coup. Number two, never look bored. Number three, wait for the other person to reveal any political opinions, then agree with them. Number four, let the other person reveal religious views and then have the same ones. Number five, hint at sex talk, but don't follow it up unless the other person shows a strong interest. Number six, never discuss illness unless some special concern is shown. Number seven, never pry into a person's personal circumstances. They will tell you all eventually. Number eight, never boast. Just let your importance be quietly obvious. Number nine, never be untidy. And number 10, never get drunk. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's going to be one more, which is never get caught. But...
I mean, if you get caught, just break out.
Just break out. Make a special rope.
Yeah. He died. His death was a bit sad. It was a bit like the boy who cried wolf, because then he did get sick, but they didn't believe him because they were like, last time you said you got sick, put you in an infirmary, you made a rope, you jumped out. So we're not believing you. But he actually then turned out he actually did have pneumonia. And by the time they took him out of jail, he lasted only 2 days.
Oh god.
But he had a daughter, right?
Was she a scammer as well?
She wasn't. But guess what? From the age of three, he taught her how to communicate with him in Morse code so that he could communicate with her by just tapping if there was police or if anyone came, so she would understand what he was saying. Wow. Like, he taught her the Morse code of, like, don't talk from the time she was learning how to speak English.
So what was her life like?
Not much is known about her life. It is known, so she did visit him at his deathbed. She did love her dad. She felt like he only scammed greedy people. Mm. If they weren't greedy, they would have never gotten scammed.
Mm.
If you weren't trying to bribe an official, you would have never gotten scammed and believed you were buying Eiffel Tower for cheap. You know, that kind of thing. So she felt like he only scammed greedy people and criminals. He was a good dad, not a great husband, had a thing for women.
Of course.
Which we won't go into, but yes. So that was true. That was a long first truth, by the way.
I loved it. It was a movie.
It was a movie.
Full biopic.
Yes. So number two was that there was a lady who did fake that she was a princess from Indonesia, but she was actually from Bristol.
Had the people of Bristol just never seen someone from Indonesia before?
So let me tell you about this. Not Bristol, the main city of Bristol. She showed up in a cottage in a village called Almondsbury, which was very near the Bristol port. And this is in 1817.
Right.
And she was seeming to speak a language that no one understood. She looked about 25. She had pale skin, dark hair. She was wearing a black dress. She had covered her hair. She had a shawl wrapped around her shoulders. And so she looked exotic to the people of 1817 England.
Also, babe.
Yeah. And they brought her before a magistrate. And all she kept making clear was that she wanted to sleep. They tried communicating with her. They brought in all these sailors to try and talk to her, because sailors would travel. So they're like, have you heard this language before? Like, what is she speaking? And all these people are like, have no idea. Like, sounds like it's from the east, but we have no idea what language she's speaking. So in these times, like, if you're a woman who, you know, no family or nothing, like, they'll send you to the workhouse. So she didn't want to be sent to the workhouse, so they took her to a home for women. And, you know, they showed her the bed, and then she went to the corner, acted like she did not know what a bed was. I was like, sleeping on the floor. And they're like, wow, she's really foreign. Like, doesn't know beds.
It must be from Indonesia.
And they keep trying to show her how to just lie on the bed. And she's like, And she sleeps. The wife of one of the village leaders, a woman called Mrs. Worrell. She was the magistrate's wife. So she was the wife of the magistrate that this curious lady had been brought in front of. She saw her and she felt just so touched and so moved by her that she moved her into her home. Mrs. Worrell was an American, and so she was a bit of an outsider herself. So she had a soft spot for outsiders, which is another thing. A con man or a con woman knows the type of person to con, right? They're trying to tap into something in you that they see. So she moved towards Mrs. Worrell in a way that she wouldn't have a purely British, you know, woman who could have found her out. So she moves into this woman's house, and they have a lot of aristocrats who come and visit her, and you know, they speak in English in front of her, so she understands everything they're saying, right? So they think they're just speaking in front of someone who knows nothing, and she's learning from the things they're saying. Like, they'll be like, oh, maybe she's from, you know, Indonesia, like she's probably from the Orient, you know, in those places they're a bit wild. So after she hears this, she jumps into a lake and starts swimming.
And
they're like, oh, she's definitely not British. Like, a British woman would never act so wild. Who would swim in open water? And they're like, oh, she's probably trying to swim home, or she's probably from somewhere with water. So they're like, okay, yeah, she's from an island. Anything they say, she kind of takes it in and builds it into her persona. At one point in time, the people are like, I don't know, this might be a scam. You know, they bring in people from Oxford.
Linguists.
They're like, let's look into her. And at one point in time, she falls asleep in front of them and starts having a nightmare in her made-up language. In fact, her language was seen to have such structure in it that they brought a linguist from Oxford and from the university in Bristol, to come and start writing down her language. So the words in her language and interpreting it into English. They wanted to build this book of the language of where she was from. And then one day the sailor comes and says he thinks he can understand her, and he makes up this tale and says, you know, she's a princess from an island near Indonesia, that she was kidnapped. She said her name was Princess Caribou.
It does sound like a made-up name.
But she said her name was Princess Caribou, and she was from some island. The sailor was like, yeah, he understood what happened to her. She got kidnapped by some sailors who had gone to her island, and when she got to Bristol, she was able to escape and swim to shore. She was living in this enormous estate that was called No Park, right? So she was supposed to be Princess Caribou of an island called Javasu. And in 1817, a ton of these visitors that were visiting the world's house started talking about the Orient and Lord Byron's Oriental Tales. And they were talking about how, wow, like, this is amazing. They commissioned a portrait of her and started looking for people who might know about the Javasu people and Princess Caribou of Javasu. So they put this in the newspaper. So the man who put this description in the newspaper, his name was Mr. Charles Wilkinson, and he was a well-known figure around Bristol. And he placed a description of her in the missing persons notice in the local paper, right?
Okay.
And he was just hoping that someone or some expert would be able to tell them where she had actually come from. And in his description, he wrote, "Such is the general effect on all who behold her, if before suspected as an impostor, the sight of her removes all doubt." It was so fantastic that it was picked up by newspapers, all major newspapers in the UK, and the article, the picture wasn't actually in the article in the description, but the description was precise enough that it caught someone's attention.
Wait, so she recognized her from the description?
She recognized her from the description.
Well, there must have been like maybe 20,000 people in the UK then.
She recognized her from the description. She said, "That is Mary Baker, the erratic child of honest parents in the humble village of Witheridge in the county of Devon." Another paper wrote, "The wonderful female who outwitted the doctor, puzzled the learned, and astonished the multitudes turns out to be a vile imposter. And the thing about it is that, like, she never broke character. She was speaking her language in her sleep. They would say some wild things in front of her to see if she would blush or understand English. Like, she was good.
So wait, when they caught her, did she...
When they caught her, like, her old landlady came. She said that Mary Baker has always been just different. She's always made fantastical stories up. You know, she was a servant until she was kicked out for burning her bed.
Okay.
Yeah, she just lived a very colorful life. So after she was kicked out from being a servant, she was trying to avoid the workhouses. So she pretended to be a prostitute and went to a home for reformed prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
While there, they realized she was never a prostitute, so then they kicked her out. So I guess around this time, she found some travelers and she realized that British people love people who speak different languages or dress differently are more willing to give charity to something they view as exotic. And so she came up with this scam.
That was interesting. I mean, maybe she just didn't like beds to begin with.
Right, because she burned her bed.
And then when they put her in the new place, she slept on the floor.
Yeah.
So this might just be an elaborate scheme to never have to sleep on a proper bed.
Yeah.
I imagine the workhouses probably didn't have spaces on the floor.
Oh my God.
We'll have to sleep properly. So after she got caught.
Or found out. The lady, Mrs. Worrell, the lady she was staying with actually had kind of just developed a liking for her.
Mm-hmm.
And so she, instead of turning her in, purchased a journey for her to go to America and start a new life.
And she went?
She went, and on her arrival in America, before she arrived in America, tales that she was coming had been going around. So people actually showed up to the dock when her ship arrived in America to meet this Princess Caribou of Javasu.
Wow.
Even though they knew it was a scam, they thought it was still a curiosity.
It was interesting, you know.
Yeah, and so she kind of lives in America for 7 years, going around as Princess Caribou, but people get bored, you know, this kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, humans do love, like, curiosities, right? It's like, look at all these movies that are being made about scammers right now, like Dear John, that Tinder swindler,
the documentaries
and the movies and the TV show
being, like, it can only hold people's attention for so long,
right? The same story can only hold people's attention for so long. So she kind of just gets destitute in America. She returns to Bristol, gets married, has a daughter, and just lives as a businesswoman with her daughter and her cats for a while until she dies.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Lived a quiet life. She died at the age of 73.
I guess she didn't really hurt anyone in her thing.
I guess so. Like, she was just living off of people's charity and also just, you know, we talk about cultural appropriation or just this weirdness of just creating some weird exotic thing.
But that's the thing, it's not appropriation here.
It's not appropriation.
She doesn't have any access to the culture. She just imagined what her fellow white people would like to see from an exotic country.
Like swimming.
Swimming.
And like, how can a woman swim in open water? She would also like duel with some... She was very interesting. She was wild.
She was dealing with
some of the visitors who came. Swords this time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
She was just... I think if you're a woman in that time and you're poor, you're repressed, you're single... She's 25, so she would have been seen as a... What's that word for someone?
Spinster.
Yeah, spinster. You know, you come from a family with a poor, humble family from a small village. And you want some excitement in your life.
Mm.
She just decided to become Princess Caribou of Javasu.
Princess Caribou.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So, Nigerian prince scams are now part of...
The global identity?
Yeah, of Nigeria. But it's also part of... What's the word called? Pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so Nigerian prince scams are now part of pop culture, but they are over 100 years old. In the early years of the 20th century, newspapers had ads for just about everything. Do you know that some newspaper ads had jingles that expected you to just sing them out loud to yourself?
And that's how you'd learn them.
Yeah.
No, that's true, because a lot of people could just read music at that time as well. It was part of public education, so they would put the notes, they would put the, you know, if you couldn't read it, you would have someone in your house or someone you could ask for the melody and the timing, and you would, that's how people learn songs.
Oh wow, that's really cool. I didn't even know that. Now, the first Nigerian Prince scam was run by a man called Prince Bill Morrison. He said he was a prince of noble birth and hailed from the far reaches of Nigeria, and all he wanted was American pen pals. So he sent this ad to the newspaper, and the newspaper found the ad so moving that they put it there for free and published his mailing address free of charge. Should the poor prince from Africa not find some good old American correspondence?
Should he not?
And he did find them. Plenty of people wanted to be pen pals with some African prince.
Right.
And he made a simple request. Would his American acquaintances please send him a mere $4 and an old pair of pants they no longer needed? You know what? Oh, this man asked for Shokutu. Yeah. he was really playing on their ignorance.
Yeah.
He said just a mere, he was like, friendship is priceless. And he said, in exchange for this $4 and your old trousers, I will send you ivory and diamonds and emeralds, because to me they're worthless. I have so many,
and I really want to be rich in friendship, right?
Yes,
now. That's the
friendship
true wealth
is
of life.
Priceless.
Oh gosh, I like this guy.
So the money and the pants poured in, but then where were these promised jewels?
Nowhere to be found.
Complaints, hundreds of complaints started flooding into the post office that this guy you people published, this Prince Bill Morrison, he promised me jewels and he's sending me nothing. He's not replying to my correspondence anymore. Wow. Turns out this Prince was a 14-year-old Nigerian.
Sorry, and this one, I just fell off my chair.
Oh my. Okay.
Just so we're clear, the main reason his name is published as Bill Morrison in all the publications about this scam is because he was a minor, so they couldn't put his full name. They couldn't put his full name out there, and they couldn't charge him. He just secured about $800 for his future with no consequences. And
a bored 14-year-old Nigerian boy said,
my name is Bill Morrison.
I'm a prince. And just send me trousers and $4.
I think my favorite thing about this story is the fact that he had perfect penmanship, apparently, but he wrote in bad English on purpose to endear himself to the public and to his pen pals and make them feel like, oh, we're dealing with a genuine Nigerian prince whose, you know, English isn't very good, but his heart is pure. And yeah, he scammed them all.
Wow. Wow. I'm impressed.
I'm genuinely impressed as well. But yeah, this all started from a 14-year-old boy. Have you ever seen a 14-year-old boy? Can you imagine the sheer goal.
Oh my gosh.
And I can't imagine, like, this is...
If you were his parent, would you be proud or mortified? I'm battling with this question for myself.
I think if you were his parents, you'd be happy because they can't charge him. But obviously, it shows this lack of moral fortitude in your child. But then, so that's conflicting. But there must also be this insane amount of annoyance from the parents because your house is just full of trousers.
Where are all these trousers coming from? Oh, mommy, it's from my friend in America. What? You know what? I think, but it shows something that we all know growing up as African children is that the West is so ignorant and so infantilizing about Africans that they would believe a prince who had diamonds and rubies to give them didn't have trousers
and had an English name, William Morrison. That's, I feel like that's the name of one of the Bee Gees or the Beatles.
Like, it is, oh man, that is, I'm really sad about where Nigerian prince scams have come in recent times, but the history is just... What were you doing at 14?
Not asking people for jeans, I'll tell you that.
Okay, I think that's our episode. I think that is our episode for today. I thought it would be nice to do scams, some lighthearted scams. Nothing too
heavy.
Nothing too heavy today. I think we've had some heavy back-to-backs. shout out to 14-year-old Nigerians. Some of them are chess champions in the slums, and
some of them were regional trouser wholesalers.
Oh my goodness.
Please don't forget to reach out to us on social media, particularly Instagram. We're getting a lot of really wonderful DMs, and we're going to start discussing them on the show. So if you have any more facts or things to, you know, share with us.
We are at The Dirty Lie Podcast on Instagram and at The Dirty Lie Podcast on Twitter. This has been Dez and
TMT.
Thank you very much. You can find us anywhere you listen to your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio. We would love to hear from our listeners. It gives us so much joy. Remember to share this far and wide, and we hope you enjoyed this one. Have a lovely week.
Bye.
Bye.